supporter of Donald Trump who traffics in anti-Semitism all the time. She didn't utter a peep of protest when he had Kanye West and Nick Fuentes over for dinner. Nick Fuentes, who doubts whether October 7th even took place because he thinks it was some kind of suspicious propaganda move by the Israelis. And the Republican Party is filled with people who are entangled with anti-Semitism like that. And yet somehow she gets on her high horse and lectures a Jewish college president from MIT.
So last year, Republican Congress member Elise Stefanik of New York was criticized for seeming to endorse the racist great replacement conspiracy theory, the white supremacist theory, maintaining white people are being replaced by people of color and that Democrats are deliberately trying to deluge the U.S. with immigrants in order to gain an electoral advantage. We all know what happened in Charlottesville, the mass protests where the Trump-supporting white supremacists kept repeating, Jews will not replace us. Peter Beinart, can you respond to the woman who's taking these women presidents, at least attempting to, and succeeded in the case of UPenn President McGill, down?
First of all, there's a tremendous irony in the fact that Elise Stefanik is supposedly so upset about people saying Palestine will be free from the river to the sea, because Elise Stefanik supports the existence of one country which denies Palestinians basic rights between the river and the sea. And as for the idea that she has some great concern for Jews, as you said, she's actually trafficked in the same great replacement theory that is what motivated the Pittsburgh shooter, because of this insane idea that Jews are bringing in black and brown immigrants into the United States to replace white people. Elise Stefanik doesn't actually care about Jews. What she believes in is ethno-nationalism. She believes in a white Christian state in the United States, and she's sympathetic to forces in Israel that believe in a Jewish supremacist state, because fundamentally she's hostile to the basic principle that people should be treated equally under the law, irrespective of race, religion, or ethnicity. She's hostile to it in Israel-Palestine. She's hostile to it in the United States. That's what motivates her.
I want to thank you both for being with us. We'll continue, of course, to cover this issue. Peter Beinart, editor-at-large of Jewish Current, and Omer Bartov, professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Brown University, author of a number of books, including most recently Genocide, the Holocaust in Israel-Palestine, First-Person History in Times of Crisis. Next up, the State Department's bypassing Congress to send nearly 14,000 rounds of tank ammunition to Israel. We'll speak to Josh Paul, who resigned from the State Department to protest the Biden administration's push to increase arms sales to Israel amidst its siege on Gaza. Back in 20 seconds.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same. And the people in the houses all went to the university where they were put in boxes.
Little Boxes, performed by Malvina Reynolds. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. As the death toll in Gaza reaches 18,000, the Biden administration's bypassing Congress to approve the sale of 14,000 rounds of tank ammunition to Israel. The sale's valued at more than $106 million. Secretary of State Tony Blinken informed Congress of the plan Friday night, saying, quote, an emergency exists that requires the immediate sale. Congress was notified just hours after the United States vetoed a UN Security Council resolution calling for a Gaza ceasefire. Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland criticized the State Department's decision to bypass Congress. He told the New York Times, quote, the administration's decision to short-circuit what's already a quick time frame for congressional review undermines transparency and weakens accountability. Well, we're joined right now by Josh Paul. In October, he resigned from the State Department to protest the Biden administration's push to increase arms sales to Israel amidst its siege on Gaza. Josh Paul had served as director of congressional and public affairs for the Bureau of Political Military Affairs in the State Department, which oversees arms transfers to Israel and other nations around the world. Josh Paul, your response to this move Friday night?
First of all, thank you very much for having me. It's good to join you. I'm sorry it's in such circumstances. I think what this move demonstrates is that nothing has changed in U.S. policy. 2 months into this awful conflict, almost 20,000 deaths later, so much suffering later, U.S. policy remains that we will continue to flow arms to Israel and to support its operation in Gaza. I think we have heard Secretary Blinken and others speaking up and saying that there needs to be a reduction in civilian casualties. But I think actions speak louder than words. You know, I've been thinking a lot these past weeks of Lewis Carroll's Walrus and the Carpenter. When you see the U.S. bemoaning Palestinian civilian deaths and yet continuing to provide the arms that are consuming the people of Gaza, it's extremely distressing and problematic.
So let's see. Secretary of State Pompeo, under Trump, previously used the emergency provision in 2019 for arms sales to Saudi Arabia and the UAE. Can you talk about the financial scale of over $1.8 billion and the types of weaponry purchased during that time and how that relates to now?
Yes, I think that's an interesting counterpart to what's happening now, because, of course, at that time, Secretary Pompeo under President Trump was supporting the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. And in that conflict, many thousands of civilians, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, died as well, many of them, again, through the use of U.S. arms. In fact, the first thing that President Biden did upon coming to office in this space was to suspend arms transfers to the Saudi-led coalition of precision-guided munitions, precisely because he cared about the civilian casualties who were being harmed. And yet here he is using the same authority as President Trump, as Secretary Pompeo, to override congressional will, to override congressional oversight. I think one thing that we need to keep an eye on is that in the wake of the decision to use the emergency authority under President Trump, Congress actually moved forward with 27, the Senate passed 27 joint resolutions of disapproval to block these arms transfers after a ruling by the Senate parliamentarian that they could do so. Will Congress act in a similar way in this effort? I doubt it, but we will have to see.
Josh Paul, can you talk specifically about the 120-millimeter M8-3081 high-explosive anti-tank multipurpose with tracer MPAT tank cartridges that are part of this deal? I probably said some part of that wrong.
No, I think you got it right. Those are essentially standard-issue tank shells that will be used by Israel's Merkava main battle tanks. These are the tanks that are currently pushing through Khan Yunis in the south of Gaza. These are the same tanks and same sort of shells that on October 13th killed civilians in Lebanon, including a Reuters reporter, in an incident that both Amnesty and Human Rights Watch have described as intentional and targeted by the IDF. You know, part of the arms transfer review process is to ask whether or not the weapons that we are providing will be used to commit human rights abuses. I think we now see a clear record of these precise weapons having been used to commit human rights abuses in this conflict. And yet here we are still flowing them to Israel.
I just have to ask before we go, Josh Paul, we spoke to you soon after you resigned from the State Department in October. This was, of course, in the midst of Israel's bombardment of Gaza, which came after the October 7th surprise attack on Israel that killed 1,200. Can you talk about the response of your colleagues at the State Department? Have others resigned in other parts of the government?
So we have seen, certainly from the UN, UN senior official Cade McIver resigned. We have not seen, to my knowledge, significant resignations within the U.S. government. But I have heard and continue to hear from many of my former colleagues who are really trying to find what mechanisms they can use to slow this down, to change the policy. I fear that their efforts at this point continue to be in vain. I think we need to see a policy change from the top. But I know a lot of good people are continuing to make the argument.
My last question to you goes back to 2021. In a recent CNN interview, you discussed a disturbing story of a 13-year-old Palestinian child raped by Israeli forces. Can you outline what you understand happened?
Yes, there was a report by a charity called Defense of Children International, Palestine, that's the Palestine branch of this global charity, in which this child had been taken into Israeli custody, which is, of course, itself a question we should be asking, why there are children in Israeli custody without charge in the Moscovia prison in Jerusalem, who was raped by his prison guards as part of his interrogation. This report came to the State Department's attention. We looked at it. We considered it valid. We raised it with the government of Israel. And the next day, after it was raised by the State Department, actually by Embassy Jerusalem, with the government of Israel, the IDF, the Israeli security forces, went into the charity's office, into Defense of Children International Palestine's offices, and ransacked it. And several months later, declared them and several other Palestinian NGOs a terrorist organization. I think sexual violence is such a horrific event, and we need to condemn it wherever it happens, whether it happens in the kibbutzes of Israel or whether it happens in the prisons of Israel.
Josh Paul, veteran State Department official who worked on arms deals and resigned in protest of a push to increase arms sales to Israel amidst the Gaza bombardment. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to look at how the Biden administration's facing widespread condemnation around the world for vetoing a U.N. Security Council resolution Friday calling for a Gaza ceasefire. The Palestinian U.N. envoy Riyad Mansour criticized the U.S. veto.
It is disastrous that the Security Council was again prevented from rising to this moment to uphold its clear responsibilities in the face of this grave crisis, threatening human lives and threatening regional and international peace and security.
The U.S. Deputy Ambassador to the United Nations, Robert Wood, defended the U.S. decision to veto the ceasefire resolution.
The United States engaged in good faith on this text. We proposed language with an eye toward a constructive resolution that would have reinforced the life-saving diplomacy we have undertaken since October 7, increased opportunities for humanitarian aid to enter Gaza, encouraged the release of hostages, and the resumption of humanitarian pauses, and laid a foundation for a durable peace. Unfortunately, nearly all of our recommendations were ignored, and the result of this rush process was an imbalanced resolution that was divorced from reality, that would not move the needle forward on the ground in any concrete way. And so, we regretfully could not support it.
The United Nations General Assembly will hold an emergency session on a Gaza ceasefire Tuesday to talk more about the U.S. veto of the U.N. Security Council resolution calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. We're joined by Shibli Talhami, professor of peace and development, University of Maryland, also senior fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy. He's co-editor of the book, The One State Reality, What is Israel-Palestine. Professor Talhami, thanks for rejoining us. Talk about the significance and the reaction to the U.S. veto of the Gaza ceasefire resolution.
Well, it's an extraordinary act. I mean, think about it this way. Whatever the representative of the U.S. says, there were 13 members, including pro-U.S. members like France, who voted for the resolution. Only one other country did not vote for it, abstain. That's the UK sticking with the US. So think about this. This is the US trying to take a leadership role globally on many issues, including Ukraine. And it goes against a global consensus on an issue that is humanitarian. This resolution didn't call for an end to the fighting and a ceasefire that ends the fighting, it called for humanitarian ceasefire. Every international human rights organization and aid organization. I talked to two heads of aid organizations just last week. They said it's impossible to address the humanitarian crisis in Gaza without a ceasefire. You can't just trickle it in. The needs are so massive that you need a ceasefire to deal with that. If you look at it also from the point of view of even American public opinion, you have a majority of Americans, according to polls, who support a ceasefire. You have, from the president's point of view, two-thirds of Democrats who do not approve of the Israeli military action in Gaza. And it's not just Democrats. You have essentially two-thirds of people of color, as Gallup polls them, including African-Americans, Hispanic-Americans, Asian-Americans, Native Americans, you have a majority, two-thirds of young people of all types, not just Democrats, who oppose or disapprove of the operations. You have a majority of women. Essentially, every major constituency of the Democratic Party, the president's Democratic Party, who wants this, and the president goes against it, and the international community. Think about what that does to America's standing in the world, let alone, obviously, to continuation of the death and destruction in Gaza. And I want to say here that it is the puzzle for me, as somebody who has known the president before he became president, somebody who's been watching, and I'm a realist in terms of how politics takes place, I'm still shocked by the degree to which this decision that has been taken vis-a-vis this particular crisis after October 7th has been a personal decision by the president of the United States. It was really acting on his preferences, his beliefs, rather, it seems to me, than the consequences for American foreign policy and for America's national interests, which have been huge from the beginning. It could have been anticipated that his massive support and even the backing of this vague idea of destroying Hamas was going to lead inevitably to mass destruction in Gaza. And it was going to, therefore, also bring possible blowback on the U.S., because the U.S. now is seen as a sponsor of this war, as a party to this war. There's a danger of a blowback that would be unfortunate, devastating across much of the Arab and Muslim world that we see now. There's also, of course, the chance of escalation that we see in Lebanon and perhaps even bringing Iran in a way that would be hugely detrimental to American interests and draw the U.S. in. And the idea that you give, you support Israel's right to self-defense, of course, Israel has a right to defend itself. Every country does. But to give that government to define what is right of self-defense when you know there are members of this government who want a lot more than self-defense, including things that are odds with American interests, that are odds with American values, and to give them license to do so, including the possibility of drawing the U.S. into war with Iran, that's the thing that seems to be shocking to me as an analyst viewing this episode in American foreign policy.
Shibley Tahami, we want to thank you so much for spending this time with us, Professor of Peace and Development at the University of Maryland, Senior Fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy. Next up, we speak to a doctor in Gaza. Stay with us. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. United Nations Palestinian Aid Agency, UNRWA, is warning society in Gaza is, quote, on the brink of full-blown collapse as Israel continues its devastating assault that's killed 18,000 Palestinians in Gaza, including over 7,000 children. We turn now to a doctor in Gaza, Ahmed Maghrabi. He works at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, one of the few hospitals still functioning in southern Gaza. We reached him yesterday.
Hello, Dina. Yeah, I'm talking to you from the Nasser Hospital. It's in Khan Yunis, south of Gaza, where I'm working as a head of plastic and burn department. It's been 64 days since the aggression actually started against Gaza. I can tell you here, actually, I'm working since the beginning of this war. Actually, I'm so exhausted. 40% of the injured people from explosions are children. They are seriously injured. Actually, this morning, I'm working since early morning till midnight, every day. We are here at the hospital. Actually, it's like a siege. All troops around us. What is going here actually is a real massacres all over around. If you see the pictures and the videos, actually you'll be shocked. There is no words can describe what is going here. What is going here actually is a real genocide. You know, hundreds and thousands of people actually are passing away every day because of these attacks. They're attacking schools, they're attacking church, mosques, civilians areas, everywhere they're attacking. Oh my God, I can't describe what is going here. It's a massacres, what is going here. The entire families are whipped out actually. I don't know really. I developed like psychological disorder to see these children actually are, you know, how to say it, like how to say, are it's I don't know how it's, they are burned till bone. They are burned till bone, children. If you see my page, you will see all these, you know, horrible. It's horror what is going here. My God, I hope this will end soon. I don't know if anybody could help us. If you hear me, actually, I thought we are alone here in this world. We are living in big prison under strict siege, actually, and nobody listen to us. Nobody wants actually to adopt our Palestinian narrative. Actually, everybody listen to Israeli narrative. Just listen to Palestinian narratives. We are here living under strict siege in a big prison. We are human being. Me, like you, I'm human being. I want to live in peace. I want a better future for my children. Really, that's I want. You know, actually Israel supported by the whole world. You give Israel these mass destruction weapons. But in the other hand, nobody gives us even food. Here, I can't find food, clean water. Me as a surgeon, I can't find clean water to drink. I can't find food. I eat only once a day, Dina. Yes, once a day. I can't afford my children food. I can't see my children because I can't provide simple, you know, food for living. I can't provide this food to my children. They eat once a day, simple rice. You know, my little daughter yesterday, 2 years old, she asked me, an apple. There's nothing here. We are dying from starvation. From everything we are dying now. All over, actually, they send these rockets over our heads everywhere, every time. Please stop this war against us. Please stop genocide against us. Stop this war, please. I beg you.
Dr. Ahmed Mograbi, who works in Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, which was one of the few hospitals still functioning in southern Gaza. We end today's show with Dr. Tarek Lubani, emergency room medical doctor who works at the London Health Sciences Center in Ontario, Canada. In 2018, Dr. Lubani was among 19 medics shot by the Israeli military in Gaza. In October, he was arrested for nonviolently protesting for a ceasefire. He's a Palestinian refugee, a member of the GLIA Project, creating open-source medical devices for low-resource settings. You hear your colleague in Nasser Hospital talking about not being able to feed his own children, not to mention what's happening in the hospital. Dr. Lubani, you're in constant contact with medical staff in Gaza. Tell us what you understand at this point.
What Dr. Ahmed's saying is exactly what we're hearing all across the Gaza Strip from the hospitals there. Really, the situation, it's not teetering on, verging on collapse. It has, the medical system has fully collapsed. And the only reason we are using these words to mitigate the devastation and the absolute collapse is because the absolute bravery and incredible resourcefulness of the Palestinian doctors, who have done just an amazing job trying to provide care for their patients. These are people, these are doctors who themselves, like you said, are starving, literally starving. They themselves are getting killed, are being arrested, or having their families harmed. And still they show up to work every day like Dr. Ahmed does, bravely, and to face a new day of horrors.
Doctors are telling doctors to leave their patients, particularly in northern Gaza, and move south. Also, doctors like the head of the hospital in northern Gaza are being arrested. Can you talk about what you understand at this point?
The arrests are a new dimension here. You know, we've always been used to a doctor here and there being killed. However, we've had over 250, I think it might even be up to 300 now, healthcare workers who have been killed during this war on Gaza. As well, Dr. Mohammed Abu Salmiya was one of the first arrested, but I can tell you the story of one of my students, a young doctor who graduated only a couple of years ago, who I've been teaching throughout his residency. He was an emergency medicine doctor. And he was, in fact, a valedictorian, Saleh Alewa, the highest ranking student in his medical class, a delightful human being who had never stopped smiling and then was arrested because he wouldn't leave his patients until it was too late. He was at Al Shifa Hospital. That's the story. His story is one of 41 stories that we have so far. Only a few of them have been released since. What the people who have been released tell us is that they are being tortured right now. They're being, quote, interrogated. And I know this because I've been in Israeli jails. I've been interrogated in those ways. I've been tortured. I've been beaten. And so I know what they're experiencing. And that was for me as a young Canadian. Now, what, mind you, these people who the Israelis want to see confessions from, who the Israelis are convinced are doing bad things, despite the fact that all they have done throughout this war and ever is take care of their patients.
Dr. Tariq Labani, if you can talk about the warnings that the death toll could be dwarfed by those who die of diseases now, with the lack of clean water, the close proximity of everyone now being pushed south, diseases like diarrhea, scabies, measles, meningitis, acute viral hepatitis. What do you understand?
Before this war, the hospitals in Gaza were full because things happen to people day by day. And now those chronic diseases, the people with those chronic diseases like diabetes or diseases that need medications or cancers, those patients are all starting to die. It's been 2, going on 3 months now that they haven't been able to receive proper care. And that means proper medical care. Now, the foundations of life aren't proper medical care. Their water, their food, their psychological safety. And so people are starting to die from those things as well. We've already had our first starvation deaths. Predictably, they're in the very young and the very old. And as time goes on, we will see these deaths start to come in from the margins, come in from people who are sick and vulnerable to everybody. Because right now, the normal Palestinian has not, in Gaza, has not been able to eat or drink for weeks, if not months. When we're talking about the treatment of many of these problems that they're facing right now, the treatment is proper food, it's rest, it's clean water, and those things are not available. So yes, the predictions right now is that in the next few weeks, it'll be like falling from a cliff, and we'll see 20, 30,000 people dying.
Dr. Tariq Labani, I want to thank you for being with us. Canadian-Palestinian Emergency Room doctor joining us from London, Ontario. Spent years traveling to and working in Gaza. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warnoff, Trina Nadura. I'm Mimi Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
The staff and volunteers at CJSF wish you a fun-filled Hanukkah and a happy new year.